You don't change a system with your fork. You change it through power and structure change. I don't want to create alternative models. We should make this the dominant model.
Welcome to the 384th installment of Ear to the Ground, the Land Stewardship Project's podcast on family farming, regenerative agriculture, community food systems, and local democracy. I'm Brian DeVore, editor of the Land Stewardship Letter. For years, big energy companies have been trying to convince the general public that if we make a few simple changes to our homes, we can help mitigate all the negative environmental impacts that come with our fossil fuel-based system. While utilizing LED light bulbs and driving cars that get good gas mileage certainly helps, such measures don't get at the heart of the problem. There's a very powerful industry that benefits greatly from the overall infrastructure pretty much staying the same. Until that system is completely reimagined, recycling and driving a Prius will only go so far in fixing the planet. Austin Frerich feels the same way about our food system. He's the author of the book Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food System, and is considered an expert on agricultural and antitrust policy. He previously worked at the Open Markets Institute, the U.S. Department of Treasury, and the Congressional Research Service before becoming a fellow at Yale University. In his book, Austin, who has been fascinated with how our industrialized, corporate-controlled food system works since he observed its impact on farms and rural economies while growing up in Iowa, takes the reader on a journey through an industry that is, as he puts it, in uncharted waters as far as monopoly control and consolidation are concerned. Others have written about big food, but what makes this book so effective is that the writer uses a series of profiles of captains of industry to show how the situation didn't materialize by accident. Policy supported by decision makers on both sides of the political aisle has played a major role in the unprecedented growth of monopoly power. As food system analyst Ken Meter noted in his review of the book for the Land Stewardship Letter, the good news is that we created this system, which means we have the freedom to build it differently. During my recent interview with Austin, he made it clear that indeed, just buying your meat, eggs, and vegetables direct from a local farmer isn't enough. We need to join together to take away the unfettered power of big food and big ag and build a new system from the ground up. I interviewed Austin on the run-up to a special panel discussion on agricultural consolidation LSP will be holding on November 4th, 2025 in Lanesboro, Minnesota. Besides the author of Barons, that panel will feature Sonia Trom Ayers, the author of Dodge County Incorporated, Big Ag and the Undoing of Rural America. Episode 383 of Ear to the Ground features my conversation with Sonia. During our chat, Austin talked about why he views rural communities as quote-unquote extraction colonies, how he sees his book as a kind of campaign, and why the regenerative slash sustainable farming movement has got to stop playing nice.
I'm from Cedar Rapids. I'm a seventh-generation Iowan. It's like this weird thing Iowans do where they talk about how many generations they go back. I went to Grinnell College down the road. First, my family go to college. I went to grad school at University of Wisconsin-Madison. After that, I worked in D.C. at the Library of Congress, a thing called Congressional Research Service, and then the U.S. Department of Treasury. Let me start by saying I've always had like a critique of corporate power. I kind of saw, I mean, to me, I saw the decay of Iowa in my lifetime. And it's also, I mean, partly to my family's always worked in the food system. My mom ran a bakery. My dad's been a truck driver for most of my life. I'm really close to my grandfather. He was in the meatpacking business and then in the beer business. And I've always just, I mean, I've kind of just seen the slow collapse of Iowa in my lifetime. And it was kind of coupling that with this corporate power thing. Like my college thesis was on the slaughterhouse towns in Iowa. I think they're the most fascinating places. I mean, some of the best food in the state. But, you know, there's some of the most impoverished parts of the state, too.
That's always the irony, too, of farming areas. We see this in across the Midwest. Acres and acres and acres of grains being produced or whatever. But you go to the local grocery store, if there is a local grocery store, and it's a food desert. There's not, if there is food available, it's imported from somewhere else. And it's not very good for you. And, you know, there's the irony of all this rich soil producing this food. And it's not going for local food.
No. I mean, that to me, the best metric that captures that is for every dollar you spend at the store, there's a certain percentage a farmer gets. After those New Deal reforms, we saw the highest ever recorded in American history, over like 50 cents on the dollar. And now last year was the lowest ever recorded, and it's like 11 cents. So yeah, like you said, the land's producing the most it's ever produced, but none of that wealth is staying there. I view these rural communities as essentially extraction colonies, and we shouldn't be shocked that the politics of anger is filling that void. I mean, just imagine what rural America would be if 20 cents, 30 cents on the dollar went back to them, instead of having them be extracted to urban centers or even outside these our borders. And just, I think your last line was really important and underappreciated, is the communities producing our food are actually getting the worst of the food system in all different ways. I mean, we saw in that failed Kroger-Albertson merger where executives admitted under oath that they were basically gouging in small towns because they had market dominance. These communities are stuck with all the environmental destruction that comes with these production models. You know, their wages are being suppressed because there's basically only one or two buyers of their labor. And, you know, they're just getting like a low quality product and like very few options. That's been the under really appreciated thing is, I mean, that to me is also really contributing to the anger you see in a lot of these communities.
The word unprecedented is used and overused quite a bit, and it is used so much these days. It seems like every time I wake up and I look at the news. But are we seeing, from your research and from what you've been seeing, are we seeing an unprecedented consolidation of our food system? Or is this an echo of something we've seen before? Or where are we at with that?
We're in uncharted waters. I mean, I think it says something that the largest private company in America is a food company. It's Cargill. The largest employer in America is a food company, Walmart. 60% of Walmart sales come from food. They're the world's richest family. Like the most powerful entities in the world, in this country, their business at their core is food. And that has been like, this is just a different age of consolidation than we had in the last Gilded Age.
One of the things that I think your book does a really good job of is, so you kind of make it this subject, which is a pretty downer heavy subject, accessible by kind of profiling almost these barons that are in your title, these folks that have been part of this unprecedented consolidation and the monopoly situation that we're in. And yet you also make the point that this is part of a system. If you focus too much on the individuals, you're like, well, as long as we get this one bad apple out of there or control them, we're all fine. But they're taking advantage of a system that we have in place. I was wondering, though, if you could describe, for example, the situation in Iowa with hogs, with that particular baron that's there. I think people would be a little bit shocked, even people who grew up in Iowa and are driving around and see some of these CAFOs, to realize how much that is controlled by basically one person or one company.
I mean, just to start off with, I'm so glad you picked up on that. And that warms my heart that my barons are narrative devices to tell these structural stories. And that's just something, it took me like 5 years to write that book. And a lot of it was figuring that out. I mean, I have a whole different book that I'll never see a light of the day. It's a pure structure. But you realize, and I think this is really important for people in our world, is you need characters. You need drama. Humans are emotional creatures at the end of the day. And I think an underappreciated thing, the reason why I love doing like talks, is I kind of view talks as like a stand-up comedy. You're trying out rhetoric, and so much of the language we've taken, like we take industry's language at face value and we use their own terms, which are, these terms are intentionally designed to hide what they're doing. Like take CAFO. In our little world, people know that it stands for Confined Animal Feed Operation. First of all, it's an acronym. No one knows what that is. Even that, when you say it out, what does that even mean? So like playing with that language to show the brutality of these production models, to me is like, I enjoy doing that. I think it's really, really important for reformers to do. So people just understand how radical the system really is. And speaking of radical, I mean, the hog baron, as you mentioned, is this chapter to me. So this whole book started in a magazine article on this chapter in Vox. And then I expanded it and I kind of rewrote it for the book. And the first version of the Vox piece, I read it as angry. I'm just pissed. I'm just mad. I'm just mad what happened to Iowa. I'm more like, I'm mad at Vilsack. I'm mad at all these people that contributed to this, to where we got to this point. And then when I read it now, is I just read it as profoundly sad. Like it all fell apart. It didn't have to. I view Iowa as the canary in the coal mine for the American food system. I mean, Iowa should be the Tuscany of North America, but instead, second highest cancer rate in America, has a water crisis. It's like 60%, 70% of the waterways in Iowa are too polluted for you to go into. And there's obesity crisis. And it all goes back to this production model that you realize it's built for Wall Street and no one else. And my hog baron is, he saw this. I mean, so much of these stories too is it didn't have to go down these roads, and USDA allowed this model to take hold. And this hog production model goes all the way back to chicken, which goes back to sharecropping, where when we wrote meat regulations a century ago, we didn't write chicken to the regulations because there weren't commercial chicken slaughterhouses in Chicago. You just had a chicken in your backyard and you killed it. So Southern corporations took that really exploited model to black farmers, sharecroppers, and applied it to chicken. US and chickens are getting a lot of market share, this really exploitative model. USDA could have stepped in and be like, no, chicken behaved like the other meats, it didn't. They call it chickenization. And you see all the other proteins are essentially going this model, and like hogs chickenized. They first actually did North Carolina. The elite of Iowa freaked out because they didn't want to lose their number one hog status. And then my hog baron, I mean, him, Jeff and Deb Hansen, I mean, it's a combination of right place, right time. They originally were building these metal sheds, and then they decided to get into the business themselves. And the other thing to keep in mind here in this like laissez-faire era we're living in is it rewards the worst actors. Mm-hmm. Most hog farmers weren't willing to stuff their animals into a metal shed where they don't see a blade of grass. And this race to the bottom, this deregulatory thing, allows one person out, one couple, essentially do 5 million hogs in Iowa. I mean, this whole book started, that whole article started in a bar conversation in Des Moines where I had heard that they were the largest political donor in Iowa in the governor's race in 2018, but it wasn't even that. It was this detail where this person was telling me they had a home out by the fanciest mall in the Des Moines suburbs, and also had a home down in Naples, Florida, and they would fly back and forth between the two on their private jet with the words allegedly when pigs fly, which, first of all, is good. Like, what incredible copy. I mean, that just says power to me, and this whole thing started. I want to understand, how did a hog farmer become so powerful? Iowa used to be known as the Middlelands, the purple state, and it has the biggest political swing of any state in the last few decades. Mm-hmm. And it's so clearly tied to this production model. And that's why I always go back to Iowa's canary in the coal mine. Do we want to go down this path? We've seen what it's done. I had a researcher at Wisconsin tell me the other day, his biggest fear is Wisconsin is basically becoming like Iowa, but 20 years behind, because it took 20 years to kill the dairy family farm after the hog family farm died. The hog family farm died in the 90s, and I would say late Obama, Trump is when the dairy family farm really died. And I mean, this is a dark joke, but you know, Vilsack oversaw the death of the hog family farm as governor of Iowa, and then oversaw the death of the dairy family farm as secretary of agriculture. Yeah. That he's the voice of Democrats. I think that tells you everything.
That brings up a really good point too, in that this is a bipartisan issue, or a bipartisan fault can be cast on both sides of the aisle there, both historically and in the current situation.
Yeah, and I mean, it always takes two to tango. I would argue one is more at fault than the others, but to me, the best example, one party they don't even pretend to be your friend, and the other one pretends to be your friend and stabs you in the back. And I think a really good example is Vilsack's re-election for governor in Iowa in 2002. Opposition to these hog confinements were one of the key issues of that race. I mean, he ran ads on it. He promised to do something. He featured people screaming for help. You had small town gyms being packed. And the way Iowa works is only the governor of Iowa can stop these construction of these industrial hog facilities. And his opponent was the head lobbyist from a hog baron. I mean, this was just an incredible race. After he won, not only did Vilsack not do anything, he oversaw the largest expansion of hog confinements in Iowa history. That just breaks people. Imagine galvanizing for years, for months, as your livelihood collapses, your quality of life collapses, and you think you have a hero. Not only is he a hero, not only does he not do anything, he actually really destroys what you've been trying to fight. And I think that, like, I compare him, and this joke only usually works outside of Iowa, but like Harold Hale, the Music Man. He's just a con man. He's just a snake oil guy. But on the flip side of all this, what gives me like the silver lining of this is, I think fixing this stuff is actually one of the most bipartisan things in America now, because everyone's seeing it's not work, but for different reasons.
Well, that's a really good point. And that's one of the things that came through in your book, is that the bad news is we created this situation. It did not happen by accident. It wasn't the invisible hand of the great economic God that did this. So that's the bad news. The good news is that means we do have some control over the situation, that we can, since it didn't happen by accident, didn't happen by divine intervention or whatever, we can have an impact, can't we?
Oh, totally. I mean, I started this whole thing of, there's a story told over, this was all about efficiency, and you realize so many of these stories, it's just about regulatory capture. I think it's really important to understand how someone amassed power so you can then change it, tweak it, and see what laws were rewritten or ignored. But you're right. I mean, this is what I really want to push people now, is I just feel like in general, in our culture, people are just dark and hopeless. And you really got to articulate the hope, like the what if. Like, here's what the system could be if we fight. And that's partly why I like use that robber baron frame, is to show people we've been here before. Mm-hmm. You know, that last robber baron era ushered in a progressive movement. And it's also like kind of cartoonish. by making these people into jokes, you kind of take away their power. And like, have fun with it. Even like when we talk about the New Deal, I mean, that's kind of like the famous 20th century era of reform. So much of the New Deal started at the local level. Like a lot of those ideas came out of Wisconsin and New York, and that's been lost. So like, that's what I really tell people now is focus on the proof of concepts. What are really cool things going on? I mean, I just know I'm personally been doing a lot of research lately into there's been a lot of cool indigenous stuff going on, indigenous food system work in both Minnesota and Wisconsin. And just like highlighting, like creating heroes, figuring out cool things. So then when we have that moment of reform, we can take those concepts and then scale them. And then take those people that built those programs and put them in the positions of power so they can then, you know, execute them.
Some of the work LSP does is around this, because sometimes it can be pretty daunting. But we have a beginning farmer training program, and we have a soil health program that really promotes these more regenerative practices. These farmers are by far the minority, very far the minority of agriculture out there. But the way we kind of see it is if we can develop that kind of foundation, that core of folks who can do this kind of farming, and then work on the policy side to create this more resilient food system and a more fair food system, that they can, they're in a situation, they're in place to kind of step in and become more of the dominant system in that food, in that food and farming system.
And just to add on to that, I mean, we're coming near a fork in the road. I mean, ethanol's going to die. Cars are moving to hybrids and EVs. That's just a fact of life. And the industry cannot acknowledge reality. That's why they're trying to do dumb things like put ethanol in airplanes. The question is, what are we going to do with all that land? So you're going to have to do a massive shift. I personally want to put animals back on pasture. That's my goal. But also, look at the soybean market right now. I mean, the system is designed to overproduce grain. So every year's record corn and soy crop. And essentially, we got basically dumped them abroad because we're producing too much. And, you know, China doesn't have a lot of farmland, so we grow their soybeans for their industrial pork facilities. Well, after all this behavior, China's been industrializing South America's soy crop. Brazil can do 2 soy crops a year, and so they don't really need us. And so every year, the farm bill keeps getting more expensive because there's a glut and we have to pay off farmers. And at some point, you know, I mean, that music's going to stop. And going back to these, you know, people doing it right. So it's great to have this, you know, I almost think of those folks as like our minor league players, but we need to get them into the majors, and that just won't happen. This world, in my personal belief, needs to be more aggressive and play power politics. They're just too nice. I mean, it was a big loss when Biden appointed Vilsack. You have to demand in these powerful positions, who do you want in these positions? Who do you want as the undersecretary for X, Y, and Z, or on the farm credit board? I mean, these are very, very powerful positions. It's been very clear that that whole Michael Pollan thing of alternative consumption just didn't work. You don't change a system with your fork. You change it through power and structure change.
There was a lot of people were trying to find a little bit of the shining, some positive out of the COVID-19 pandemic. And one of them was, well, this shows how fragile our food system is. And once we get through this, people are going to realize we need a different food system. It's not as resilient as we thought it was. Was that a little bit kind of naive or overstated? It seems like that's not kind of, we're kind of back to where we were and probably even worse in some ways.
Yeah, I would say that's just a good moment where, I mean, I also compare it to like child labor in the slaughterhouses or like the way workers were abused by the meat packers. You had a moment where the public was demanding reform. We saw the debt, we saw the negativeness of this production model. And the fact is our public servants failed. There's no reason why the meat markets got more concentrated under Biden, but they did. And we see how fragile these concentrated systems are. But here's the thing, the past will just repeat itself. This thing will happen again. These systems will break. They'll get more fragile. But at some point, we're going to have to change them just because they're too fragile and they're too expensive.
I wanted to back up a little bit. Say, for example, the situation with the hog industry being taken over in Iowa. It's very obvious to people in rural communities and farmers the negative impacts of that. If you're a farmer who has been pushed out of the business by one of these big operations, or if you're somebody who has to live next to one of these. I guess for the general public, the consuming public, the eaters out there who just want to, you know, they're just fine with, maybe they aren't paying attention to how healthy their food is or the source of their food. Why should they care? I guess we are, like you said, we're in uncharted waters, but for most folks, is that kind of working out for them, or why should they really care? And why should the general public care?
Great question. And like, that's something, that's why the first slide I tend to show when I give talks anymore is what Americans spend on food per person compared to other countries. Because industry has always justified these destructive production models because it keeps saying, oh, the system makes cheap food. you know, for a long time, we just, again, it goes back to don't take what they say at face value. Double check it. Indulge me for like a nerdy moment, but they are technically correct if they say it's percent of income. What Americans spend as a percent of the income on food is the lowest in the world. Here's the thing. We live in such a have-have-not society. So much of those income gains were experienced by the top, you know, people in like Edina. But the bottom half of Americans have not seen that. So that doesn't really matter to them. When you actually pull that data set from USDA, and also this is a really good example of USDA actually has really good information, but they frame it in a very pro-industry way. But if you actually pull the data, this is my like nerd CRS part showing, but if you pull the data per pupil expenditure, and this is what matters, especially the bottom half of Americans, is we spend more money than like Germany, UK, Canada. We're about dollar for dollar with Italy. And we shouldn't be shocked. I mean, I think food is the most concentrated space in America, and you're being gouged. That's what concentrated markets do. They act like cartels. I mean, I think everyone, that's why I actually think this is what gives me so much hope is, I mean, you're having stories of there being potato cartels. You know what I mean? Like these things are getting so ridiculous. And like so many people look at the store and they're like, this is just not fair. And like, not only is this a high price, the quality, especially in meat and dairy, has really collapsed. Inputs really matter. Cows on pasture are going to make such a better butter than cows eating corn in New Mexico feedlot. And so that's what like really gives me hope here. It's just this model has just run itself into the ground. And at some point, the question is, some party's going to tap into it. Because this you talk about this stuff, it's very machismo, it's very Teddy Roosevelt. We're tapping into something we've done in past American history, so it's not that scary. And so the question is who?
One of the things that I think that's really been exciting about your book coming out is how much attention it's gotten. I think the timing was good. It's also a good book, but you did your homework. You got a lot of footnotes. You did your research. You just weren't just kind of making these assumptions. You really kind of backed up what you were saying and kind of almost turned the industry, the information out there against the industry, so to speak, that you kind of showed, hey, I'm not just making this up. These are the facts out there. Talk a little bit about some of the reaction that you've gotten, because it seems like you are tapping into something. And I think you've come out, have you come out with a second edition, or you are coming out with a second edition?
So we just issued the paperback earlier this month, and that included a new chapter on Sysco as my distribution baron. I mean, Brian, the funniest thing about this book was when I do talks, people tell me about all the barons I missed. So I have like a whole, I call it my purgatory folder. I just put all these ideas. And so Sysco is the one I kept hearing a lot about. And it's one of those things, like you type into Google Scholar Sysco, there's no one studies it. And like, there's such a mismatch of like, you know, you talk to any chef or any people in the restaurant industry, they have so many strong opinions here.
And Sysco, boy, that affects all of us. I mean, we go anywhere, any institution.
The genesis of that chapter really came from, so you probably have noticed I talk fast. So I've been trying to slow down by doing talks at nursing homes. Someone gave me that idea and I really like it. Because trust me, they are not shy about if I'm talking too fast. Usually this involves a meal before or after. And first of all, you have that food. It's awful. And a lot of nursing home food. And the residents, that's usually what people complain about, kvetch about. You know, I understand like you can't really salt, you have to like pull back in certain areas, but just the quality was so bad. And you sit there and think about it. Like my husband also works at a hospital. I went in one day and we had lunch and it was worse than school food I had growing up. Oh, wow. And it's like, you sit there and think about the places where it's the most important, our children, our hospitals, our nursing homes, we're serving our worst food. And I think that to me says so much about how broken this all is right now this whole food system is like, it's good food for the yuppies or good food for certain people. And my whole goal is to essentially improve food at Dollar General.
And that's always been a little bit of a bugaboo that the regenerative or sustainable ag movement has struggled with is, are we just creating healthy food for a certain class of folks?
And yes.
Kind of a two-tiered system or a three-tiered system.
I don't use those words. I mean, they're just a little, the word regenerative got co-opted. When Cheerio says it's regenerative, you're just kind of like, okay. I don't want to create alternative models. We should make this the dominant model. And at some point, it's great to have these proof of concepts, but what are you going to do with them? You know, are they going to let them peter out? Or are you going to make them go mainstream? And I think the question here is we should go mainstream.
Have you gotten any reaction from the industry to your book?
Well, let me just say on the reaction. Again, it's really weird to say this, given how dark stuff is in America. I am shocked at how like weird the politics on this stuff are. I mean, like, I have been on Glenn Beck's TV network down in Dallas. I've been in large cattle conferences in South Dakota. I just did a big vegan festival in St. Paul. Everyone just agrees. I mean, that it's such a weird thing to see in America right now. I did get some pushback from the hog baron. Generally speaking, though, most, and this is a talk, Eric Schlosser, the guy who wrote Fast Food Nation, has been kind of my mentor in this. He wrote my foreword, and he sat me down before the book came out and kind of gave me the talk of what to expect. You know, 10, 20 years ago, they used to attack you in the media. Now they don't really. They know that actually kind of plays into you. But what they do instead is a lot of authors make their living now through speaking fees or, you know, giving a talk on college campuses. And what they do is they try to get you canceled from behind scenes. You know, put pressure on. I mean, I'm looking at my wall right now where I had an email forwarded to me from my boss where a head of a pork association in Iowa emailed a pretty threatening email to my dean. And like, I know if I was at Iowa State, I would have been fired and not know why, to be really blunt. And you hear these stories, like a lot of people that have been pushed out for pushing these reform measures. People just want to survive this moment. They don't want to talk about it. They don't want to draw attention. I know that because I'm at Yale, you know, the hog industry doesn't have that much power there. And so it's just something to be very cognitive of. When the cargo is bigger than the Koch brothers. I mean, there's so much money. There's so many people invested, not so many. There's a very few very rich people invested in the system that will do whatever they can to maintain the system. But you have to essentially accept that and go big at home. I mean, that's my logic here is, if not now, then when, given this moment in American history?
People are, and we're having organizing meetings where we're having folks show up, and they are very aware of the impacts of consolidation, impacts of ethanol run amok, of the CAFO system. The challenge is them not feeling so overwhelmed and so helpless that to try to get them to actually take action. That seems like the big issue right now is,
yep.
is so people don't feel hopeless and just go, well, that's just inevitable. It's the way it's going to be.
And that's why one of the last solution slides I always end with is join a group. Like, you can't do this alone. And that's something I really learned from Julie Dunn. So my book opens with Julie Dunn. She's a retired administrative assistant in Eldora, Iowa. And she just spends her retirement fighting hog confinements. I mean, that's the thing that I don't think people appreciate. The people that get the most stuff done in this space are pissed off old ladies in rural America. They go to every meeting. They know everything. And she always told me, you can't do this alone. She's part of a group, Iowa CCI. You know, you're going to lose most of these fights, but it's all about a few victories here and then, and also, you know, cracking the ceiling. Because she's like, I'm doing this for my granddaughter. It's what she always tells me. That's why I tell people is do something collectively, get in a group. Social media makes you lonely, and also focus locally. Like, really, because here's the thing, a lot of people are doing really cool things. And it's just like, especially like in Minnesota, you guys have such a good newspaper. Like, I don't think Minnesotans realize how abnormally good the Star Tribune is compared to other Metro papers. Do these proof of concepts and then brag about it. So that way other people can read about it. You can't predict anything anymore. Like that's what I always go back to is at some point you just got to play your own game. What are you trying to do? What's your 30-year vision? Because some years you might make big gains, other years it might be stagnant, but you got to know where you're trying to drive your ship. What gives me the most hope now is I've been so lucky with this book. I mean, I've been like over like 20 states, places in America I'd never been before. And just seeing I always compare it to like that story of blind people touching an elephant, describing something different, but it's an elephant. That's how I see the food system. I basically have treated my book like a political campaign. I mean, I come from politics. I mean, to be frank, I ran for state senate in Iowa and lost by 143 votes. It broke me, but I realized in retrospect, first of all, it was the best thing that happened to me because I learned so much. I learned from, honestly, so much of my obsession with language comes from knocking doors. So much of knocking doors is you got to listen, and two, you got 10 seconds to sell someone. And so like your first impressions are everything. You know, you talk to anyone in the book world, publishers really don't do much for you anymore. So I knew that going into it. And so just going big right now, I mean, it's powers that be win when people don't pay attention. You got to put on a show. You're never going to beat them dollar for dollar. It's all about, you got to lean into the David versus Goliath of it all. And it's fun. It's fun to kind of play this way. There's something kind of scrappy about it. Especially right now, you got to see something, say something. That's something I tell people all the time. Journalists are your best friends. They're moving a mile a minute. They don't make a lot, but you got to essentially get these stories out there. You got to let them know about the shenanigans you see, but also people doing cool stuff. Don't get mad on Twitter. That doesn't do anything. Send nice emails to journalists, and that really helps shift the conversation.
For more on Austin Frerich and his book Barrens, as well as LSP's November 4th, 2025 panel discussion on agricultural consolidation, see the podcast page for Ear to the Ground episode 384 at landstewardshipproject.org. As I mentioned before, episode 383 of Ear to the Ground features a conversation with Sonia Trom-Ayers, the other panelist participating in our November 4th event. You can find a link to that interview on our podcast page. If you have comments or suggestions about this podcast, contact Brian DeVore at bdevore@landstewardshipproject.org, or you can call 612-816-9342. By the way, it helps us greatly if you can give Ear to the Ground a rating on whatever podcast platform you utilize. And word of mouth is the best way to spread the news about our podcast. If you like what you hear, tell at least one person about LSP's Ear to the Ground. Thanks to Laura Borgendale, Western Minnesota musician, for Ear to the Ground's theme music. And a special thank you to all of Land Stewardship Project's members who make initiatives such as this podcast possible. If you're not a member, visit landstewardshipproject.org to learn how you can support LSP. Thanks for listening.